Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb, we had the pleasure of speaking with Rachel E. Sanborn, MD, co-director of the Thoracic Oncology Program at the Robert W. Franz Cancer Research Center and Earl A. Chills Research Institute at Providence Cancer Institute, and Yusef A. Ghaffar, MD, a medical oncologist at Maryland Oncology Hematology, to discuss the cost of care in advanced non-small cell lung cancer, frontline treatment options for patients without driver mutations, and optimal adverse effect management strategies for approved regimens. In our exclusive interview, Sanborn and Ghaffar shared insight into the clinical and economic considerations for treatment in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. Thank you, Dr. Sanborn and Dr. Ghaffar, for joining us on an episode of EncLive On Air. It's great to have you both. To kick things off, we are going to discuss the use of immunotherapy in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. We've seen that immunotherapy has shown significant benefit as a frontline treatment in advanced driver-negative non-small cell lung cancer, both alone and in combination with chemotherapy. For you, when you're making decisions between the two approaches, does the durability of response offset the cost of treatment? Kind of, could you provide some perspective on that when you're having these discussions with your patients?
That's a very good question to ask, and it seems like it would be a very simple question to answer. It is actually one of the more challenging questions that we have out there. So cost-benefit analyses so far, particularly in lung cancer, have been extremely limited, and the data that has been published is generally from other countries. And so that data is very difficult to extrapolate into the United States populations into the United States healthcare system to be able to put it into perspective. And the challenges also are that not only are different costs of drugs negotiated in every country, but even within the United States, every healthcare system and every insurance company negotiate costs of the drugs differently. So this leads to a significant variation in the cost between regions and patient to patient. Doctor may see different patients in an oncology clinic for which the projected total cost of very similar immunotherapy will be different based upon the contracting for that patient's insurance company with that particular healthcare system. So that makes it very difficult for the oncologist even to be able to have a good understanding of what to be able to quote to that patient or to be able to discuss in any kind of significant detail. That being said, we have to acknowledge the fact that no matter where we are, the costs of immunotherapy are tremendous, and that these are incredibly expensive drugs that if we look at over the provision of the long term, are not going to be feasible or sustainable as they currently exist. But we also have to balance that with those significant improvements in survival and the fact that we can see multi-year and even five-year survival in patients for whom that was not fathomable just a few short years ago. And we have to then balance those costs with also the conflict of the ethics of a potential, quote, denial of therapy that we don't want to do. And particularly when we look at the fact that these are patients in very vulnerable populations and tend to be very stigmatized and marginalized already. And oncologists want to advocate for their patients. That's a long-winded answer saying that we don't know the full details to be able to answer the question, other than knowing that it's very expensive and looking for better. We would all like to see better ways of making that change, but it's also a difficult one to put numbers on right now.
Dr. Ghaffar, would you echo those sentiments, or what are your thoughts on the matter?
Yes, I think there are also externalities that come into play as well. I think the use of direct-to-consumer advertising, particularly for immunotherapy, has basically heightened the expectations of almost every single patient that they're going to receive immunotherapy in one way or another. And I think when patients hear about miracles, in quotes, about these particular treatments and that we have improved survival for these patients with lung cancer, the patient will often say, where and when can I sign up? I think the next step that needs to be looked at is, can we determine a finite duration of therapy? I know that's being looked at, whether we can say, okay, the goalpost is 2 years of immunotherapy, for example, in the CheckMate 9LA and 227 studies. And then I know it was treatment to progression in patients receiving treatment through the KEYNOTE-189 regimen. I think the question, it's still going to come up, is how long do I need to be on the treatment? Can I afford it? I think is another key question. So whether it's going to be single agent immunotherapy, chemo immunotherapy, double immunotherapy with chemotherapy, or double immunotherapy alone, you know, all those do have a, you know, huge price tag. And I think that trying to get that understanding, at the same time trying to shy away from the ethical dilemma that are we rationing care for these patients, I think that's a key thing that still needs to be answered.
So then, Dr. Sanborn, as you said, you know, you can't necessarily accurately quote a price of a regimen to a patient. So then in those initial discussions, are you just presenting them with the data?
So I have to confess that that's generally where, like, particularly when we're having the initial discussions with the patient, at that point, those are highly emotionally charged visits, as the patient is generally dealing with their new diagnosis of metastatic disease, which is the context that we're having this conversation in, and grappling with the grief already of that discussion of their diagnosis, their stage, the goals of treatment, what that treatment is, and what the side effects are. And by the time you get through that PARQ, including the alternatives, including the option they have to say thanks but no thanks, and what that option is about allowing for those patients who would choose not to have treatment as well, and validating that as a choice, then many times patients have hit their limit in what they're able to absorb. And plus, I find that during that visit, those are the visits in which you're trying to work to establish the rapport and work to establish the trust and work to establish the fact that you are the advocate. And it can then be a struggle or a challenge, I'd say a challenge, to then say, and this is expensive, and to not have that feel like the patient is being faced with that choice of whether to take that treatment and what they think that relative benefit to society is. And maybe there are others out there who have better experience with that, but that's a lot to cover in a visit and to leave the patient feeling emotionally supported.
Now that I'm thinking about it, you wouldn't be able to make these decisions without having the patient's PD-L1 expression as well. And that's not something you can accomplish prior to the visit. So that would be something that would have to be discussed.
Well, I would have to say that that all depends on the site. Like, if for our institution, then at the time of diagnosis for a cancer, the PD-L staining is performed as reflex testing through pathology. The NGS is performed as a standard of care reflex through pathology, so that generally by the time the patients are coming to the oncology clinic, we have that information back. That's not the case for everybody. And it is very true that in those initial visits, then one is talking about those next tests. But usually then by the time you're talking about the actual treatments that you're giving, you will have the PD-L information and mutation studies back.
Dr. DeGoffar, have you had a similar experience?
Yes, I think there's a lot of pressure on both sides. I think the patients will often tell me they've not gotten a good night's sleep before they've come in to see me. And then the process of registering and then going into the exam room, reviewing all the data, all the tests, including the PD-L1 and next generation sequencing results, which we'll often have, but may not have, right, immediately available. Even if it's been sent off, and then trying to have the patient understand the type of cancer, their stage, and the potential for which types of treatment they're going to be receiving. Yeah, it's a lot to pack in. In my practice, what the financial counselors will do is once a regimen's been recommended and ordered, they'll review that with the patient. And then we have patient advocates that will look for if there's a need for copay assistance and then, you know, what potential out-of-pocket would be. I've been in practice, both in a hospital-based practice and also now currently a private practice. And I think that's the one piece that's kind of behind the scenes that at some point you wish you're involved with, but at the other point you wish you're not involved with, because that makes the decisions even more challenging. Okay, I want to give them the best bang for the buck, but at the same time, don't want to bankrupt them. So what I review with the patient is what their goals are. Do they have some milestone that they're aiming for, or what they're hoping to achieve with the treatment? Is it improvement of symptoms? Is it, you know, extending survival? That sort of thing. So the cost does get factored in there, but in my practice, it's still a lot of it's behind the scenes.
And there are differences that we have to look at in terms of what is the cost to the patient versus what is the cost to the healthcare system. And I agree that the financial coordinators, financial counselors are tremendously helpful in talking with and discussing with the patients what their cost is. Because many patients come in fearful, am I going to lose my house if I get treatment? And many patients will even say, as you're just meeting with them, I don't want any treatment if I lose my home and I leave my family bankrupt. And you have to say, well, that's not going to happen that way. We're going to be able to find you financial assistance. We're going to be able to work with copay assistance. We're going to be able to do those things to make it feasible for that individual patient. But at the end of the day, you're still finding a way to get that medication paid for. And it's that total cost of pay to the system that we have to look at it in terms of what that does to the entirety of some total healthcare system. That is, that's where our greater challenge lies. But is that a very acknowledged challenge to be having in the context of the oncologist in the exam room with the individual, rather than in larger societal structures about maybe not how do we provide less care, but how do we make that care more affordable overall?
Now, in terms of the considerations that go into the ultimate decision, I would imagine for a lot of patients, it's not just about the efficacy of the regimen, but the toxicity that accompanies it. So, Dr. Ghaffar, to your point about time on treatment, what are we seeing with, for example, the KEYNOTE-189 regimen versus CheckMate 227 and other chemoimmunotherapy versus dual immunotherapy regimens that are now approved?
In terms of making cross-trial comparisons, that's somewhat difficult, but I think that looking at the, you know, KEYNOTE-189 regimen, it's sometimes a little more challenging to tease out what are the side effects of the chemotherapy, the typical side effects of chemotherapy, and then whether immunotherapy is adding additional toxicity that needs to be managed. At least my experience, it has not been tremendously different in terms of additive side effects or in that combination. The majority of my patients have not required hospitalization. Do they develop immune-mediated side effects that may need to be managed with steroids? Sure. I think particularly in this day and age with COVID, one of the key things that patients worry about is the development of shortness of breath or related to pneumonitis and then having to be on steroids for that or developing COVID, period. But I think the general concern that patients have, whether they're on the KEYNOTE-189 regimen or the CheckMate 227, is that, is this treatment going to land me in the hospital? And patients will oftentimes wait until they can really take it no more in terms of side effects. In giving the CheckMate 227 regimen, the side effects are different that in my experience in terms of patients having more issues with potentially fatigue or immune-mediated side effects. But I think it is possible to manage these side effects as an outpatient for the great majority of patients, and they don't end up landing in the ER. They may land in the office to have some office in-office management or infusion suite management. But in my experience, they're comparable in that patients do not most of the time end up in the hospital as a result of the treatment.
I would add to that with the initial question about the different durations of therapy on these, I would say that when one is comparing all of the different possibilities that we have now in the first line setting for different approved regimens, whether it's single agent immunotherapy, whether it's chemoimmunotherapy, whether it's immunotherapy doublet agents, really the duration of treatment on any of those is not significantly different. In terms of all of the different studies, the duration of therapy are largely similar, and that's not really something that drives the decision-making process. Basically, the concept behind though treatment in the current era for these patients, for patients with advanced lung cancer, is the idea of a chronic treatment and a chronic management, different than in the past when we would talk about four cycles of a platinum doublet chemotherapy and then a chemotherapy holiday and then second line therapy at the time of progression. This is more of a chronic management world for this now. And the thing to break through with patients with those discussions is that people will come in and say, I have to be on treatment until I die then. And that's not really the concept that we're talking about. We're talking about being able to manage the disease and treat it steadily and chronically, in which patients are doing better with that than an on again, off again. And reassurance still offered, that means that they're not living in prison and that we can still factor in vacations and we can still, COVID aside, but we can still get people to be able to travel and to be able to live their life, because that's the whole point of the treatment, is to help somebody live their life.
Now, as Dr. Ghaffari, you were saying, we don't yet know what the optimal duration of immunotherapy is yet, but with the data that we have to date, what do we know about the potential treatment-free survival of the therapy?
That's an interesting question, because I think that's a concept that's been really highlighted in patients who have been treated for melanoma, in terms of looking at time off of all therapy whatsoever. I think in the KEYNOTE-189 regimen, in the extended follow-up that was looked at this year, 14% of patients were off all therapy on the chemoimmunotherapy versus 8 who are just on the placebo and chemotherapy. So I think there is still some data evolving on this. And then in the CheckMate 227 regimen, there has been longer follow-up where patients who, if they're responding at 6 months, tend to do much better in terms of survival. And there was a time course limit of 2 years on that regimen, or in the 9LA regimen. So there needs to be more evolution of, as patients go out further and further, particularly in a 189 regimen, being off of therapy and still doing well. I think that data is still evolving.
The cautionary and humbling note that we still face is that we have yet to see the same type of survival curves that are existing in melanoma. We see better survival curves than we ever have for lung cancer, and that's really fantastic. But the truth at the end of the day is still that on all of those treatments, all of those different regimens, the median duration of treatment is anywhere from 2 to 7 months because patients progress. So should those patients be lucky enough to be in that small minority of patients who are at that longer term point of stopping therapy, that's a bridge we still have to cross when we get there for those patients who are lucky enough to be there. And we don't have a reliable enough prediction up front when we're talking about initiating treatment yet to be able to say with any great certainty who's going to be in that group or who is not. So we have a long way to go scientifically in order to be able to look at those same type of tails on the curve. Someday we'll get there. That's my optimism.
Now, turning to toxicity management, how are the adverse effects of immunotherapy typically managed? Are patients typically counseled on what to expect?
So when I am meeting with a patient and consenting them for immune therapy, separate from a chemotherapy consent, immune therapy consent is an entire fireside chat in itself about what immune therapies are, how they are different than chemotherapies or targeted therapies, what they do in the body, and what their benefits and their dangers are. And I have an entire discussion with them about different types of toxicities, different types of symptoms to monitor and communicate about, and the absolute critical importance of good communication with the clinic about anything they feel is changing, because even sometimes something that seems subtle to the patient might be something extremely important to the oncologist. And we talk about that the point of that is to keep the patient safe and to keep them feeling well so that we can intervene with something early if we need. And reassurance is offered that for the majority of toxicities, they are things that can be easily managed, and in so doing can keep a patient on treatment. But we also have potential for life-threatening toxicities with patients. There are a number of different guidelines that are now published through the American Society of Clinical Oncology, through the NCCN, through the Society for Immunotherapy and Cancer, that are all readily available and open access. And I would strongly encourage everyone in oncology to familiarize themselves well with the management algorithms. If toxicities are managed strictly according to the algorithms, patients do far better. And so those sometimes will require an intensive amount of clinic visits and monitoring time, and frequent visits and ambulatory oxygen saturations and x-rays and labs and many other more time-intensive interventions, but then can keep the patients safer and feeling well. So at least in our clinics and our practice, we follow the management guidelines very strictly, including the initial grading of toxicities in order to be able to track them.
Yes, I echo that completely. And I think the other thing we try to do is, as they're having regularly scheduled visits, they're going to have it either in person or we'll make that virtual as well to really get understanding what side effects that the patient's having from the particular treatment. And that even if the immunotherapy has been stopped, that some of these immune effects can carry on, and that we may need to get other specialists involved, such as ophthalmology, dermatology, cardiology, pulmonology, endocrinology, gastroenterology, to really have those patients managed well. Because at the end of the day, if the patient may enter that small category of patients that do really well and end up having a very well chronically managed lung cancer, but at the same time, they still may develop toxicities that need to be managed. And I always recommend that, yes, we're going to go over the side effects, but you may need to see other specialists to help manage that, to manage that side effect. So same as Dr. Sanborn was saying, you know, making sure the patient understands from the outset that immune-mediated side effects are not the traditional chemotherapy side effects, and that there may be short-term effects and maybe long-term effects, and we're going to do the best we can to help them and making sure that the patient's reporting that. And then, as Dr. Sam was saying, making sure that we're grading that in the appropriate fashion, so everybody who lays eyes on the patient, including our advanced practice providers, have an understanding where the patient is in managing those side effects.
Is there anything else related to the use of immunotherapy in the metastatic setting that you'd like to emphasize to our listeners?
I would say immunotherapy is here to stay. It is a major part of any medical oncologist's armamentarium now for virtually every cancer. And it is really critical to be able to understand and familiarize oneself with the management, and to be able to be proactive. Having that multi-specialty team involved for toxicity management agree is absolutely, absolutely critical. But having each oncologist familiar with the agents, the risks, and how to monitor and intervene, that's just part of oncologist life now and can't be avoided. Nor should it be.
Yes, I think understanding, you know, having the patient understand that, as Dr. Sanborn was saying, immune therapy is here to stay, but really try to emphasize to the patient and try to get a really good understanding of what their goals are. Because if I've had discussions with patients and they're like, look, I understand I could potentially get some benefit, but I have, you know, I have lived a good life. I'm very willing to, I'm willing to having my symptoms managed by palliative care. And that's where I am, versus other patients who are like, look, I want even 6 more months so I can see my daughter get married. I mean, I think that is really I'm happy that, you know, with the advent of immunotherapy combinations or immunotherapy alone, we can help these patients achieve that, potentially achieve that goal. So I think that's always a key part of the conversations I have with patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Bristol Myers Squibb. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.